important time. One of the public radio hallmarks is programs like 1A that bring together people who have different opinions, different voices, in a civil and respectful conversation. So we're so honored to have Joshua Johnson here, the host of 1A, and our own Allison Bektash, who will interview him. Please welcome them.
Thank you all for coming again to our sponsors for allowing this to happen. And you hear us say it all the time, we're member-supported Aspen Public Radio, as you'll hear during Pledge Drive for 2 weeks straight. More than 50% of our funding comes from you. I would say more than 90% of our energy comes from you. And attending something like this means so much. So thank you very much for a very busy week in Aspen for taking the time to come out here. Trying to suck up. Come on. I do think it means something that this time last year we had beer on tap. This year we brought out the tequila. So it's been quite a year, and we have lots to talk about.
What happened last year that I need to know about? Bet you had to go to a stronger spirit.
Well, it's been quite a year. I would say November had something to do with it.
Okay, all right. I'll grant you that.
As you know, I like to play games. And in order to get to know Joshua Johnson, I'm going to play a little make-believe with him. He's a theater major in college. Is that true?
That's true. Theater and broadcasting. I was a double major.
So here we go.
Listen how quiet it just got. You can't wait to see how she's going to embarrass me live. Well, here it comes.
We'll make it speedy. So this is kind of like right as it comes to you. Joshua, describe the set of the off-Broadway production of your childhood.
Set of the off-Broadway production of my childhood, infinitely high bookshelves.
Okay, perfect. Who would play you in a one-man show about your college years?
Me. I don't want to have to tell any other actor that much dirt about me. I would rather just tell it on myself.
All right, perfect. I want like a character description of the first boss you had as a journalist.
I walked into the newsroom of the local TV station that I had grown up watching and idolizing, smiling, and he looked at me across the assignment desk and said, "Why are you smiling?" And I said, "Because I'm happy." To which he responded, "We're going to beat the happy out of you."
And he did. It's gone?
That's good. Well, no. I got it back.
Okay.
I'm in Aspen. How can you be sad in Aspen? Come on.
All right, the critics' review of your first morning live on KQED in San Francisco.
First morning live in KQED in San Francisco?
Yeah, like what does the critics' review come out the next day? How did you do?
Hopefully promising and room to grow.
Okay.
I don't ever want to get an A+ on my first test because then there's nowhere to go but down.
Right. Tony Award category that describes these last 6 months since you launched 1A.
Probably.
Microphone, please.
I'm thinking. Best new play.
Okay, great. Title the future play that is a retrospective of your career. Fair question.
I can't answer that one.
Okay.
If I knew, that would mean my career was going to be too predictable. I really don't know. I'd rather be surprised.
So we all know Joshua now? Okay, great. Okay. Now that you're an open book and we can get right down to it, we were chatting earlier this week, and you said that if you had just been asked to fill in for Diane Rehm, so if they had said, "Hey, we want to do the Diane Rehm show featuring Joshua Johnson," you would have turned them down. I'm wondering why. What was there that would grab you and that you wanted to change?
Well, if we were just going to be doing a new version of the Diane Rehm show, basically, just call it the Joshua Johnson show, but with the same, you know, theme music, like, I wouldn't have wanted that. I have never had interest in my career in doing a job that's already been done. I've always been creative. I consider broadcasting to be a creative medium for me. It's kind of, I do believe in the art form of broadcasting, and I've always wanted to create something. So the fact that WAMU had already decided, first of all, you know, what do we want the future to be, and left it open, and then made an affirmative decision to carry on a two-hour national program and to build something new for 2017, that was what enticed me. It was the chance to build something new. So if it had just been like, we want you to be the next Diane Rehm, I don't want to walk into that buzzsaw. Like, that's a setup. Nobody wants to be the one to follow Diane Rehm, because then you will never fill Diane Rehm's shoes. I can't fill Diane Rehm's shoes. They're size 8 and pointy. There's no way. So I knew I wanted to do something new that would speak to the country as it is. And I knew, because her run was going to end after the election, that whatever came after 8 years of the Obama administration was going to be very different and was going to be historic of its own merit. Regardless who won the election, they were going to be following 8 unprecedented years in America, and that was going to require a new conversation. So I'm glad we get to do something new that hopefully fits these times.
So how would you, well, first of all, did Diane Rehm give you, what did you ask her? And did she hand you down like a zinger that still comes into your mind sometimes when you're wrangling guests?
Diane has not given me one word of advice.
Did you ask her?
No.
No, didn't care.
Not really. I mean, she, to her credit, when she was done, she was done.
Okay.
She did her show. She gave it her blessing. She wished me well. She finished up her run and she moved on. Like, she, the handover was as seamless and as classy as it could have possibly been. As classy as you think Diane is, she is. I mean, sharp, tough as nails, active, just jetting around the studio, doing her thing. But she let us build it. So she really took her hands off it, which was exactly what we needed.
So 6 months in, mm-hmm. What is the Joshua Johnson sound? What is the new thing that 1A has brought?
I think that 1A has tried to bring what NPR has brought basically since it signed on in 1971, for 2017. Diane and I have a lot in common. We're both very devoted to civic dialogue. We're both very curious about the world. We are both deathly allergic to double talk. And we both believe in the power of public radio to be a force for good and a civic institution in the best sense of the word, in terms of a place where people can come together in like a shared space and deal with whatever it is that we need to deal with. So that didn't change. I mean, I learned how to do talk radio partly by growing up listening to Diane Rehm. So she's part of the skill set that I built. The new thing was a program that would hopefully meet a need in 2017 when many Americans, millions of our neighbors, are just tearing their hair out because they can't deal with one another. We've always been tearing our hair out as a country. But I think now, because of the digital age in which we live, because of social media, because things just change, we need a conversation that's built for now. So it's the same kind of value set that fans of public radio are used to in a different structure that hopefully meets these needs.
We're going to talk about 1A. And I know that most of you are dedicated listeners and have a very specific question, why he didn't follow up when guest so-and-so was talking about topic so-and-so. And we are going to go to audience questions at the end. We're going to kind of peel back a more general curtain on the show. It's called 1A. It's cutesy for the First Amendment. The tagline is speak easy.
Speak freely.
Speak freely.
No, speak easy is where the tequila is over there.
Clearly still in need of that.
Yes. Have you had a sip? I have not.
Neither have I.
No, I know. No, tequila and me, no. I do enough dumb stuff on pure air. I'm never. Mm-mm.
Next year.
Josh, how you doing? Ha. Okay, come on. We're taking you home. Let's go. No, not on my watch. No, no.
So, theater major.
Yeah.
No.
Exactly. Right. There you go. Exactly. And I'll tell you something else, theater major fellow.
I went theater aspirin. We'd like to invite you to come to the show Hairspray.
I would love. When is it running? Oh,
let me direct you.
Okay. Well, but I wanted to, just in regard to the theater major, I will say that a lot of what I gained as a host now, I gained directly from my study of the performing arts, because that taught me a lot about character, about conflict, about narrative, about storytelling. It taught me to understand what is at stake for someone as part of a conflict and to view something through the eyes of people with whom I bear no resemblance. I think a lot of what's wrong with the discourse, and this is about 1A directly, is that we have a hard time empathizing with people. And I learned how to do that through the performing arts. there are many ways to do it, but for me, I was kind of fortunate growing up as a theater kid because it taught me to step outside of myself. I think what we don't do well these days that we try to do on 1A is give you a chance to step outside yourself and view the world through someone else's life. And if I ask the right questions, if we build the right conversation, if we book the right guests, then you get to take this little voyeuristic trip through someone else's head. And you can understand, even if you disagree with them, like, oh, I get it. That's why you think what you think. I still think you're wrong, but at least now I understand what's behind it, and you're not just some caricature of one of those people. Does that make sense? Like, that's kind of what we're, that's what we're going for in the show on a daily basis.
1A, First yes. Amendment, freedom of speech. But then I hear you say stuff like an earlier talk at the Ideas Festival this week. I'm not debating science on 1A. Climate change is climate change. We're not letting someone on who's going to debate that. So how do you balance free speech? What about hate speech? I mean, how is there a bad part of free speech?
Well, there's
You're
two parts of
that. You're allowed to lie. That's
yes,
free speech.
Yes, you are allowed. Lies are protected by the First Amendment up to the point where they do demonstrable harm. Okay. So you can tell a lie, but slander is not protected by the First Amendment. Yelling fire in a crowded theater is not protected by the First Amendment. So there's that. But in terms of, for instance, you mentioned climate change. We will let people on who are skeptical about climate change if I don't have to entertain their skepticism, as if it is equally valid as the scientific consensus that humans are causing the climate to change. That's not something I'm flexible on, because facts have to matter. But I can't complain about the war on truth and, oh, facts don't matter, if I don't stand up for that. And we've had this happen on the show, where we've had a few guests who are like, well, the jury's out, the science isn't clear. And I've just had to slap them live on the radio and say, look, there is no scientific evidence of a strong enough consensus to override the consensus that there is no other vector for the rise of carbon dioxide rates in the world's atmosphere besides human intervention. Zero. Show me evidence and we'll do it a different way. And I have to defend that. I can't be a journalist and play flimsy with facts. However, when someone comes forward with something hateful, there's a larger reason to kind of put that off to the side, which is it's probably not productive. You know, we've had debates in our newsroom about whether to let on some of the most virulent provocateurs of our time. And I won't call their names. You probably would recognize them if I called them. You might recognize some of them. And we think, well, maybe there's a value in being able to talk to them, and we can get something out of them. And there may. Like, I may be able to have a great interview with whomever. But it's like that old saying about why you don't wrestle with a pig. You know? You never wrestle with a pig because you walk away dirty and only the pig enjoys it. No matter what I do of value in that interview, I as a human walk away feeling filthy. And there's another way to talk about hateful speech without inviting the hater on. Maybe we invite someone who's been a victim of that. Maybe we invite someone who's trying to counteract that hatefulness. Maybe we invite someone who's made a study of it, whose community's been affected by it. There are other ways to talk about this subject. And that way it's about the hateful idea and not about the hateful individual. It prevents me, in my flawed humanity, from being tempted to beat up this idiot for being so nasty, and it allows me to keep the conversation on a higher level. So it's not that it's not acceptable anywhere. It just may not be the best, most incisive, most creative use of your airwaves. And remember, these are your airwaves. Aspen Public Radio literally belongs to you, and we are guests on your air. And if we are not good stewards of the time you give us, then the station's management it behooves them to pull us off. So we have to be very careful about how we spend every minute of every hour that we're on Aspen Public Radio and all the stations we're on. And for that reason, we don't make conservative decisions in terms of being fearful of talking to people. We just try to be shrewd with your time. And if there's a better way to go, we'd rather just take the high road.
A lot of what we heard after the election and, again, during the Ideas Festival right now is that there's a big portion of America that just wasn't feeling heard. Can you explain that to me? Because it seems like more than ever, by the media, you can directly interact. Instead of writing a letter to your local paper, you can tweet to the editor of the New York Times. Why aren't people being heard? How is that a new problem?
Well, people are being heard. It is easier to be heard. It's hard to be listened to. And there's a difference between hearing and listening. You know what I mean? If you want to be heard, you can holler on the corner of Monarch and Main, and now I can hear you. But if you want to be listened to, then that involves me being willing to connect, to invest time, to be quiet, which for someone like me is very challenging, and to actually show you that I care about what you have to say. John Maxwell once said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I find that a lot of people who a number of news organizations talked to during last year's election were very clear they weren't really being cared for. We just need to get the soundbite from you so we can keep covering the election, so we can keep, you know, this epic political drama going. And that's just, it feels like you're prostituting people and their lives and their stories and their needs and their frustrations and their wants. A lot of the American people are very upset about the state of affairs, and were before the election. But I don't think it does us any good to just let people yell into the ether, even if they're making air on CNN or in the print of any major newspaper, because there's no connection and there's no real respect. There's no opportunity for me to be changed by the interaction. I go in, I know I need a soundbite from a liberal and a soundbite from a conservative, and I need to edit together and make my deadline. That means you are here to serve me. I have a deadline. You are a person whose story I want to extract, and I will extract it and leave. It doesn't allow me to be surprised by what you have to say, or to go, oh, we have the story wrong, and to call my editor and say, I think we need to rethink this story. It doesn't allow for that. I think what we need to do is give people more opportunity to be listened to, which means they need more spaces, and I hope every day that 1A is one of these spaces, where when they come on our air, they know that we care about what they have to say, especially if we're talking about something painful, where they know they'll be treated with respect, no matter what, as long as they respect the other people in the conversation, and as long as they know that they're not just grist for the mill, but that we literally can't do this show without you, that you're kind of co-authoring the show with us, and that you have the ability to move the program in another direction if we think we're right but we turn out to be wrong because your real lived experience proves us to be wrong. I think that's kind of the difference, is that when you're listened to, it's an exchange, you know, it's a give and take. I have to dance with you. If I'm just hearing you, you just need to follow my steps. And if I step on your toes, well, too bad. You should have followed closer. That's not the way this should be.
So what's the process for curating that, both your guest and who gets to have part of that dialogue on that day's 1A?
Well, we kick around story ideas every morning. We meet at 8 to talk through that day's show and to figure out what we're going to do the following Monday. Usually the second hours of 1A are scheduled further in advance. The first hours tend to be a little bit more on the news of the day, so usually we'll kind of pitch ideas around for first hours. It's myself, our executive producer, Rupert, who is around here somewhere, and our producers, including Danielle Knight, who is here. She was producing from Aspen, and we will send ideas around and figure out what we want to do. We get ideas through the web. If you go to our website, the1a.org, there's a link that says Ask 1A, and people will suggest story ideas to us, and we'll pull stories from there. And then we figure out how we're going to tell the story, what we're going to focus on, what kind of people we need to talk to, how we can make the story distinctive or different or engaging or interesting or compelling or fun, or just make it so it's not predictable.
Is that through guest selection? How do you make it fun, especially some topics that we talk about these days?
Well, some topics are not really meant to be a lighthearted conversation. You know, let's talk about the budget, kids. No, it's not going to work like that. But we have a diverse interest in stories. So we talk about politics and science and art and culture and movies and books, and, you know, we started a movie club where we'll say, hey, we're going to watch a movie and then talk about it on the air, and we'll review the movie live. Last month's movie was Wonder Woman, which, if you haven't seen it, what is wrong with you? Go see Wonder Woman right now. For God's sake, out of 5 stars, it was
give
six.
It 20 minutes.
Exactly. It was a 6 out of 5 stars. And so we just mix it up so that we don't feel like we have to chase kind of the calamity of the day in Washington, right, D.C. We can do kind of whatever we want to, and we can talk about the kinds of issues that voters said were very important to them, but that didn't really rise to the top of the agenda. So we talk about, you know, budgets and health care and school funding and caring for rural communities that are disenfranchised. We talk about all those different things because they matter.
I assume you're getting more questions and people wanting to participate than can make any given hour. So you are still kind of a gatekeeper. You're curating whose question and whose opinion makes it on the show. Is that live during the hour, and who gets to make that call?
Yes, we have in the control room, there's the engineer who works the audio board. There is another producer who, there's a space for another producer who will man the, or staff the video feed, run the cameras, or who will do phone screening on the days that we have live calls. And then there's what's called a line producer. The line producer is the producer that oversees the show during the show. And so the line producer goes through email, Facebook, Twitter, and picks the ones that she or he thinks are the most germane to the conversation. If we get a bunch of messages that are kind of along the same line, then I'll get a little note in the software that we use that says, got a lot of comments like this one from David in Aspen. And then the comment will be there. And then I kind of try to keep a half an ear on the conversation and a half an eye on my screen so that I can figure out which of these comments flows neatly into the show while I'm reading through my script, while I'm figuring out my next question, while I'm getting messages from my producers, while I'm deciding on the next clip, and while I'm watching the clock and the timer. So there's a lot of air traffic control that goes on.
Does that always go smoothly then?
So far, so good. Okay. But it's live. It doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, I know that NPR has this reputation for being absolutely perfect. But it's live, so, you know, it's not going to be perfect. We'll just try to make it as good as we can.
I want to talk about the journalist's role in our society these days and circle back to free speech just for a moment. Journalists don't say how they feel about things. We kind of protect our opinions. Though everyone knows when there it seems to be that most media, as you tune in, you know what they think. You know how what angle they're going to take. Is it good that journalists say that we are objective, that we're neutral? Or is it time to say climate change is real, even though I'm a journalist?
I am a journalist, and climate change is real.
Okay.
Neutrality is a tool. No one is truly neutral. I can't be neutral about racism. If I was neutral about racism, you would think I was from another planet. I can't be authentic and be neutral. What I can do is practice neutrality when necessary. I used to work in research labs. I was on the track to be a doctor before I settled down and went into something steady like journalism. And what I noticed was a number of physicians who researched things like cancer or HIV or whatever had a personal story about why they got into it. You know, I lost my mom to breast cancer, or I lost my partner to AIDS at the height of the epidemic, and so I decided to become a researcher, and I'm working with Susan G. Komen for The Cure, or the American Foundation for AIDS Research, or whatever, and they get into research. You see them in the lab, how's it going? I would expect these motivated people, like you see in like the Person of the Week, and they're just crusading, and they're going forth, and they're like, I got stuck in traffic. Another crazy day, lots of paperwork. Okay, let's get on with this. And they just kind of do their job. They lay that emotion aside, they do their work, and they go home. Doesn't mean that it doesn't matter to them, but they just got a job to do. If I can't put my emotions on a story aside, I can't do my job. My mind will be so addled by my emotions that I can't think, and I won't do my best thinking. Neutrality means acknowledging my biases and choosing to leave them outside the studio. I can pick them up when I leave, they're right there. I don't have to disavow my beliefs, but you're not entitled to them because they don't help. They don't do you any good. And I don't have to pretend I don't have the beliefs that I have. I don't have to pretend that I'm apolitical, that I'm neutral on everything. That would be a lie. You would know I'm lying. But we can also make a compact with one another that I'll do my best to keep my biases outside the studio for the sake of the conversation that benefits you. I don't have to pretend to be someone I'm not. That's neutrality. Neutrality is a tool. Everyone has the capacity to be neutral. Everyone has the capacity to look outside themselves and say, okay, why do you think this? In that moment, you're beginning to practice neutrality. Because you're not talking about why you're thinking about it, You're inquiring as to why someone else is thinking. And the minute you start to open your mind to that, you can ask the next question. Well, I believe in such and such a policy because I think it's good for my family. Next logical question. Okay, why? Well, my family went through such and such a situation, and this is what happened, and then the law changed, and it hurt us this way, and so now we support so-and-so. Okay, well, how has that worked for you? And on and on. I mean, you can play this game in your head. You know, I'm no smarter than any of you. You know what questions there are. That's neutrality. So I don't think that we as journalists have to pretend that we just have no feelings about this. We just have to make it safe for people like you and me to step outside of ourselves and give ourselves permission to view someone else's life through their eyes. Then when you're done, go right back into your own head and live your life. But it's a skill. And if we practice that skill, we're all the better for it.
I have a multi-pronged question coming up.
Well, I'm not a big talker, but I'll do the best I can.
When are you having your peace time? When are you collecting your questions? Are those unrelated?
Well, the producers for each hour take the first stab at writing the questions for the hour. So I do have, as well as take the first draft of the script. So I do have a lot of help in terms of just ideating the raw script. I guess for me, it's a little different because I'm used to doing my creativity on deadline. So I really don't have the luxury of having a process necessarily. Like I have an office with a door I can close and I can play some music, but that's about it.
What do you play?
Just background music, just something very light. Depends on what mood I'm in. But I've learned not to get too dependent on being in just the right surrounding, with just the right music, got to have the aromatherapy going on, like none of that. Because on deadline, like some days our morning meeting is 20 minutes and some days it's 50 minutes. And I still got to write the billboard to the show. The 60-second introduction before the newscast is called the billboard. So I've still got work to do. So I just have to be able to get out of my way and say, write it. Just write it. You can't edit what you haven't written. Best way to break through writer's block is take 5 minutes, 10 minutes, put yourself on a timer, and write the worst possible version of whatever it is you have to write. Write something that you would be embarrassed to show yourself. And then edit that. And often that's what I do. I just write a really crappy billboard, and I look at it, and then I'm like, oh, it's not that bad. And then I can fix it. So my process is a little different.
Thank you. Then I want to know what you are wondering about the public right now. When a guest calls into the show, or literally the questions that are about to come in from our audience, what are you seeking to know about Americans right now?
I think the main thing I want to know from Americans is, are you okay? Like, really? Like, are you all right? Because I feel like we're very wounded, and I feel like there's a brokenness in this country. I feel like a lot of people are really struggling, and they're furious, and they're losing hope, and they're ready to turn on one another. I feel like we're becoming feral and bellicose and volatile, and I feel like we've just decided that, you know, the train's about to go off the track, so blow the whistle. Like, I feel like a lot of Americans have just lost hope. And I think I would really like to know if America's okay. And I would like to know what's wrong. I wish we could have a heart-to-heart conversation with one another and just check in after the election we've had, after the era of the war on terror, after the economic collapse. I feel like we've gone through so much, we're kind of walking wounded in this country, and we've never taken a moment to say, are you okay? I wish we could peel that back. I know it's not very newsy or brainy or deep or thoughtful, but I'm worried about people. And I feel like we need a minute to just say, I'm not okay. As an American, as a citizen, I'm not okay, and here's why.
I think it's a beautiful question to ask your friends and neighbors, strangers, people who don't agree with you. Is someone brave enough to ask our first question here at the microphone?
Oh, I think I saw you at the festival.
He's on the starting block. Mm-hmm.
Go Gators.
There you go. He knows because I'm a Hurricane. He says, go Gators. Yeah. Yes, you can play football. Okay, fine.
Well, you know, I have some place to go, so I had to jump in the front of the line. But
that's all right.
But I think I'd like to know, I think you are, if I'm not mistaken, interviewing Elaine Chao soon?
We were going to. The scheduling didn't work out today, but we hope to soon.
Well, my question was, what will you be asking her since she's been silent, almost invisible, and I hope that you will get a chance to interview her?
Well, I wanted to ask her a bunch of things. I wanted to ask her about, you know, the president's $1 trillion infrastructure proposal, you know, roughly $200 billion from the government, and $800 billion of private investment for a little more detail, because that's still a little fuzzy. We got a lot of questions from listeners about the future of Amtrak, so we wanted to ask her about that, and also support for mass transportation. I also wanted to ask her about the commencement that she gave. She gave the commencement this year at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, and she said something that I wanted to kind of question her on a little bit. She said, one of the clearest beacons you will find in carrying out your duties is the motto of the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, which is acta non verba, or deeds, not words. Deeds will define your character, and character will determine your career and your legacy. And I wanted to ask her a question about the Trump administration in character and what she thought needed to be done to build trust in the character of the administration, since she said, character is your legacy. I think there are very worthy character questions to be asked. And since she brought it up, it felt like a polite but incisive way to ask the question. And hopefully we'll still get the chance.
So as a follow-up, is she dodging you, or is it just a problem with the
Oh, I don't know. She had a meeting. Mm-hmm. She had the meeting, and we weren't the meeting. So I really don't know.
Next question.
Hi.
Good evening. Hi. What kind of senator would you be?
Oh, I would not be. I would be one of those probably in the Roman Senate who gets stabbed right after Caesar. Like, I wouldn't last long. Politics is not for me. You're welcome. Politics is not in the future.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. As a longtime artist, studio artist, that has felt a place in society to stand on the fringes and speak into our society, I'm feeling very lost. You ask me if I'm okay, I'm not okay. And from your vantage point of having interviewed so many different kinds of people, what do you see the power of the arts becoming in this climate?
Well, I think the arts have, and we've been doing a couple stories about the intersection between the arts and today's world. There's more that we want to do and will. I mean, obviously the arts are certainly speaking to what some people are feeling very directly. I think the arts are being as provocative as they can be right now in ways that are really very interesting. And in that, I include things like Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. You know, live theater is an art, and it's just televised live theater. And I think it's speaking to people in a certain way. I think late night comedy is speaking to people in a certain way. We have been putting together a program. We'll do it. Again, the scheduling gods were not on our side, but with the creative teams behind shows like The Americans and House of Cards, who feel like their work is cutting too close to the news these days. So there is a lot to be said about the intersection between the arts and culture. We recently did one about the staging by the Public Theater in New York of Julius Caesar, with a very Trump-like Julius Caesar,
right,
and what people thought of that. It's a jumping off point. You know, sometimes through the arts you can say something that you don't know how to say. You just have to kind of, like, express it. It's like, you know, you can't be an impressionist about some of the things that are happening these days. You have to be an expressionist. And I think there's room for both, but it challenges us to be able to view things the way the artist intended them. You know, it's like why some people don't dig modern art, because it's just like, I don't get it. I can't quite see it. It's another way to challenge us to view something through someone else's eyes, through the arts. And sometimes, like I said, sometimes I don't know how to explain it to you. I got to paint it. I got to write it. I got to compose it. And then, like, ask me about that thing. That thing I can do. And it's just it's another way in to have the conversation.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Hi.
Hi.
I have to admit, I have not heard your program.
Get out.
But I...
Give this man a drink and get him out. No.
But I did listen to Diane Reams quite often, and she was really terrific. So...
I mean... You caught that, right? By the way, for those of you who are Diane Rehm fans, you know she still does a weekly podcast, right? It's called Diane Rehm On My Mind. It's still at drshow.org. It's on the Apple Podcast app. She's producing great shows every week. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, to follow up on that,
yes.
You must be pretty good if you were in her, taking over her position. So that's quite a compliment.
Well, thank you.
So anyway, you asked about how people are feeling. And I'm very sad about the country. I'm very, very sad about the way things are happening, the discourse between everybody. I can't even watch the news anymore. It's just so depressing and upsetting. And I just wonder, now that you have a platform, how are you going to address that problem, the people that are hurting, to try to bring us together?
Well, first of all, thank you for your honesty. I know it's not always easy to say that you're hurt, because that's not something that people talk about, so thank you. I have a hard time watching the news, too. Sometimes I need to step away from it. So don't feel bad if you have one of those moments where you're like, got to unplug, can't do this anymore, got to go binge watch Kung Fu Panda or something. Like, that's human. That's normal. What's wrong with Kung Fu Panda? Hey, I bought a PlayStation, all right? I have never owned a PlayStation. I was like, I make enough money now to buy a PlayStation 4. I bought a good PlayStation with the VR headset and everything, and I dare somebody to laugh at me for it. So unplugging is very healthy. I think what we try to do is a couple things. One, we just try to be empathetic and listen. Two, we try to create a solutions-focused space on the air. It's not just about letting people fight it out, but about trying to figure out, to be clear about the debate, and then try to think about the way forward. And then the other thing we do is we try not to always harp on the things that hurt. Like I said, you know, we did a show on Wonder Woman. We did a show recently on Jeopardy, because now you can take the test to be on Jeopardy online. Yeah, and so I thought, oh, is this a way to diversify your contestant pool? And as it turns out, it was, because they were getting the same kinds of people over and over. And so they thought, well, if we put it out on social media, maybe we'll get more people from different walks of life to play the game. It was great. We got a great response. And first hour was something like the budget. It was something very heavy. But you mix it up. You don't force yourself to wallow in what's hard all the time. You give yourself permission to do something light. And then you go back in. And then you do something fun. And then you go back in. And then you go to your comfort zone. And then you go back in. You go back and forth. It's not your responsibility to bear this alone. We bear this together. And we need to take a break. So take a break.
I want to follow up. That's a great question. Thank you for coming. People are segmenting themselves, though. People are getting that feedback loop. You can be as diverse and eye-opening as you want, but if they don't have the radio on, they're not part of that discussion. So how do journalists get into a conversation that they're not allowed in?
Well, social media helps a lot. We have a great senior editor who's in charge of our digital strategy, Gabe Bullard, who does terrific work online. And so we try to make sure that our stories are well-written for the web and compelling and fun and creative, and that we are active and responsive. We make sure that social media comments are part of the show as much as we can. And then, honestly, I don't feel responsible for reaching everybody. Okay. I can't reach everybody. I would love to reach everybody. I can't reach everybody. And really,
but you would love to.
It's well, and actually, no, I wouldn't. Okay. I don't think that we should reach everybody. I don't think it's, at least in public media,
yeah.
I don't think it's my responsibility to reach everybody. When we started the show, we did a number of events at WAMU in D.C., where we're based. And we had a lot of members who said, oh my goodness, in these crazy times, what are we going to do? How do we reach these people who need to be reached? What are we supposed to do? Mm-hmm. It feels like we're preaching to the choir. And I said, well, then if you're in the choir, then get down from the choir stand and go evangelize. There are people you can reach who I can't. You can get in their bubbles. And I don't judge your bubble. Maybe you built your bubble because you figured out that there were certain places in society that did not welcome you, and there were certain places that did. And what looks like a bubble is really a scar. I can't judge why you built your bubble. I built mine. So instead of judging you for your bubble, I try to reach the people I can reach and turn you into evangelists to go tell somebody about something you heard on 1A or something you heard on Aspen Public Radio that you think might be of value. So if you're worried about this bubble, when was the last time you tweeted out a link to somebody? When was the last time you shared something on your Twitter feed or your Facebook page? Or when was the last time that you told somebody, hey, I heard this thing on Aspen Public Radio. I'm going to, yeah, thank you. Then you're part of the solution. But see, that's part of what it takes, is giving people the agency to go share this with others. That's how we solve this. We can't do this by ourselves. If you're not an active community around this institution, it'll be okay. It'll kind of, you know, flounder along, but it'll never reach its potential unless people like you help. One of my favorite lines from Dr. Seuss is one of the last lines from The Lorax. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.
Two more questions? I see them both.
Yes. Hi.
Go first.
Although you were trying to be a gentleman, I appreciate that. You did the right, 10 points, you did the right thing.
Ladies last.
We say the best, for, exactly, but not least, certainly not least. Yes.
My name is John, and I guess my question regards the current climate surrounding credibility of the journalistic institution. I think in these times with like the recent election and administration.
Did he just ask your question?
Yeah. Oh my goodness, sorry.
Get in there.
Yeah, no, I think like it's perhaps, you know, bringing very dangerous ramifications into light in the near future, and I'm just curious like what you specifically and NPR are doing to address that, combat that.
To address like false information and...
Yeah, and just like the fact that like people, the common person doesn't know what information to trust. Like, is CNN true? You know, is NPR true? Everyone has such an extreme bias, and I think this administration has played heavily on that. Like, people don't know who to trust and where to get like real information these days.
Well, I would push back a little bit on your characterization of the common person. I don't think there's anything common about being an American. I think we are inherently uncommon people. And I find very shrewd and very savvy. I find that people who, you know, at a certain point, you get tired of being ignored, and you seek validation. And I think that some of those sources that you may be concerned about are not successful because they've deceived people. They're successful because they have tapped into people who seek validation for their worldview. So at NPR, we do things like annotating speeches. They've done, you know, State of the Unions, for example, where the president will speak or give an address to Congress, and then NPR reporters and editors will annotate that speech. There's that. We can do our best to be well-sourced on the air. And then ultimately, I don't have the power to stop people from doing the fake news thing. And by the way, I hate the expression fake news, because if it is fake, by definition, it can't be news. Thank you. So we should call it what it is, propaganda, falsehood, lies. We should just call it what it is and not use this crazy fake news term. But I don't fault you for that. The best we can do is be as solid as we can. I can either spend my energy beating up these so-called fake news sites, or I can invest my energy trying to serve people who want to hear what we have to provide. And I choose to use my energy serving the people I can help, and then create an institution strong enough that when those people come around, we're here for them.
It makes me think of something I learned when I was in grad school as well, where if you ask someone, do you believe in fake news? Can you tell the difference? They say, yes, absolutely. Most people say, yes, I can. If you ask them, can your neighbor tell the difference? They say, no. So there's no way both of those things are right, and it's part of the talking to your community and kind of getting on the same path for that. Okay. So since we doubled up a question, we have time for a goodbye quiz. 1 minute. You don't get it.
Oh, wait.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Just a quick one. One more quick one.
It's a lighthearted one.
Okay.
And on a more positive note.
Yes, please.
You mentioned doing more fun episodes, and I shared the Disney one with all my Disney-obsessed family members and friends. What has been your favorite fun episode so far? In Pie in the Sky, what's a fun one you would like to do in the coming months?
Favorite fun we've done so far, we had a panel of comedians, political comedians, Robin Thede, Trey Crowder, who's known on YouTube as the Liberal Redneck, and, oh, I'm forgetting the third one. Oh, I forget who the third one was. But they were just diabolical. They were so out. Nagin Farsad, who did a comedy tour called Ask a Muslim. They were so raw and so, like, right on the edge. And just kept me on my toes for the entire hour. It was very self-deprecating. I was completely out of my element, and I loved it. It was really great. I was the Martin to their Lewis for an entire hour, and it was really fun. What fun would we like to do? The live show we did at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where we did the Friday News Roundup with an audience of 400 people, that was fun, and it was live. A lot of audience shows on NPR are to tape, and we did ours live, which I thought was an achievement. But I'm open to ideas. But I like...
I like people, as you can tell. I like people.
1A with Joshua Johnson is on Aspen Public Radio from 9 to 11, Monday through Friday. Many people worked very hard to make this event happen. Thank you to our sponsors, our chef, our beverages, you for attending, and of course, Joshua for being here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.